Busy midweek Wednesday edition of Connecticut Today on the final day of April, April 30th, 2025. We opened up the show, I did, wondering if the General Assembly is about to open a legislative door just a bit to a possible mileage-based user fee to supplement or replace the state gasoline tax. Yankee Institute Labor Fellow Frank Ritchie talked about former Connecticut State Colleges and University Chancellor Terrence Chang stepping down but still getting a full year's pay. CBS News legal analyst Thane Rosenbaum joined us on the latest legal twist in the ongoing Mahmoud Khalil case, while Hearst Connecticut Media senior editor and columnist Dan Haar updated us on the biggest statewide stories, including the latest revenue figures. I'm telling you, it's coming. I was warning you about this. A lot of people were laughing online and laughing at me on the air, and I said, no. It's coming. No matter what they were saying in the General Assembly, no matter what our state House and state Senate members say of either party, no. It's coming. What is it? Well, I've been talking about this for, since I've had the good fortune almost 6 years ago to get hired here by Connoisseur Media on the Ray Didio with you every day, a per-mile usage fee to either supplement or replace the state of Connecticut's 25 cents a gallon gasoline tax. Now, it wasn't enacted yet, but let me lay this out for you, okay? Then I have a question, and you know what the question's going to be. We'll start off with this. We have a lot coming up on the show today. But just to be good to you and to tell you that the reason I geek out and read all this stuff is so I can keep you, my furry little friends, informed on this. So I'm reading stuff last night after the show, sitting at home at my pudgy suburban white guy bachelor pad, reading stuff, and I see this from our friends at the Inside Investigator. The Connecticut Inside Investigator, Catherine Revelo, who's been on the show here a few times. Legislators move to add new tax on car sharing services. Now, that's not the warning. The car sharing services, whatever, deliveries, car taxes on these sharing services, there's a 9.35% sales and use tax that's currently on short-term rentals. It will go to other car sharing services, blah, 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 blah. Okay, that's not what I'm talking about here. So I'm reading Catherine's story. I'm going, okay, Senate Bill 1447. And I scroll down. And once I scroll down, I see this. I've been warning you. A lot of you laughed at me. I said, no, it's coming. To quote from Catherine Revelo's story in the Connecticut Inside Investigator, quote, the bill also contains a section repealing a prohibition on the state DOT using state money to study mileage-based user fees, also known as vehicle miles traveled. Now, we've heard ever since 2017, right? We've heard for the past 7 or 8 years, hey, don't worry, mileage-based user fees, basically a penny or two per mile, how long, you know, for how far you drive in a given year in the state. Oh, those aren't coming. Well, how do you know they're not coming? Well, we said they can't happen. Yeah, okay. Sure. And the check is in the mail. Yeah, okay. So back in 2017, when a lot of people started buying and driving EVs on the road in Connecticut, it's been about 7, 8, 9 years, roughly about 7, 7.5, 8 years. A lot of people started saying, people who actually had a brain in Hartford, there are some of those who said, hey, wait a minute, these EVs and even these hybrids, it's either no use of gasoline or less of a use of gasoline. We're going to lose money in the special transportation fund. So maybe we're going to have to look at you and I and everybody here paying so much per mile that we drive. Now, a lot of people said, well, no, you can't do that. In fact, we're going to pass a prohibition against any state money being used to study this. Well, big whoop. Now, at the time, the bill had over 40 co-sponsors, says here, from both sides of the aisle, and got hundreds of pieces of testimony, largely from residents opposing tolls. Okay, yeah, that was part of the toll thing, too. But the bottom line is, everybody in Hartford knows this is coming eventually. It has to. We're selling less and less and less and less gasoline. That means there is less and less and less and less being collected, ipso facto, from the state gasoline tax. But there's more here. But let me start out with this. And we do have a question up today. Facebook.com/voiceofct. Because, folks, I'm telling you, this is coming. Not this year, not next year, not the year after. But I got to tell you, I think within 5 to 7 years, you and I, God willing, if we're still on this beautiful earth, we will be paying, maybe in lieu of or along with, a mileage fee, a half a cent per mile, 1 cent, 2 cents per mile that you and I are driving. Because you know what? All those EVs and the hybrids, they use less and less gasoline. So the tax has to come from somewhere. You okay with this? I'll give you my thoughts on it as to whether or not I'm fine with this. I lean toward yes with caveats, but you tell me. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC, talk or text. Would you be open to paying a per mile road use fee instead of the Connecticut State gasoline tax? So when you and I are out there driving, tootling along on state roads, the fine men and women of the DOT are out there, and they're getting paid. And part of their pay, I'm not sure what the whole pay structure is, but part of the funding and part of the payment for DOT projects on the Merritt Parkway, on the Wilbur Cross, 91, 95, Q Bridge, Sikorsky Bridge, Housatonic Wheeler Bridge, Moses Wheeler Bridge, all that stuff is paid for by, or in some way, shape, or form is paid for by some tax revenue. And some of that money, at least, comes from the state transportation fund. And you and I pay into that state transportation fund every time we put gasoline in our vehicles, or diesel for that matter. Some of us use diesel vehicles, some straight gas, some hybrids, but along with the hybrids, there are some people who drive EVs and are not paying anything. So you don't have to be an economic rocket scientist, nuclear physicist, orbital mechanics guy to figure out, hey, the more EVs that are out there and the more hybrids that are out there, the less money that's going in to pay for road repairs, and the less fair, I hate using that word, but this is one of the few times I think it's good, the less fair it becomes to people like you and I who may be driving, you know, hybrids or regular gasoline-powered vehicles to pay into that. So when this came up 4 or 5 years ago, pre-COVID, around tolls, and tolls were killed, the General Assembly stepped back from tolls, and they also passed a bipartisan measure back in 2017 that prohibited using any DOT state funding to study mileage-based user fees, MBUFs is what they're called. Because, listen, legislators of both parties in Hartford, they were feeling the heat a little bit on the tolls. So because we were heading into the 2018 elections, they said, hey, not only are we saying no tolls, we're saying no usage fees. Well, wait a minute. There's a problem there. And I'm trying to be fair here. I am as anti-toll and as anti-tax within reason as the next person. But you got to get money to fix the roads. You have to. It's only fair and it's only right. So it's, and I kept telling you folks, the mileage-based user fees are coming. They're going to have to. I don't love it. You're not going to love it. But listen, I deal in reality here on this show. I don't let partisan sloganeering get in the way of something that, you know, invariably has to be dealt with, you know, using some modicum of reality here. And the bottom line is, I see this the other day and I go, it's finally happening. There's a separate bill being considered in Hartford right now on a completely different tax to do with car sharing services and rentals, whatever. But then you scroll down here in this summary of the bill by the Connecticut Inside Investigator, and you see this. The bill also contains a section repealing a prohibition of using DOT money to study mileage-based user fees, or VMTs, vehicle miles traveled. Folks, it's happening. I told you it was going to happen. Studies of VMTs have been previously used to help states set tolls. Connecticut's ban on studying VMTs was passed in 2017. The bill had over 40 co-sponsors from both sides of the aisle. So, folks, listen, I hate to tell you this. I hate to be the bearer of bad news here. But something is coming here. Tolls are not dead. Mileage-based user fees are not dead. We're going to need the revenue. Every single electric vehicle sold in this state chips away at gas tax revenues to fix the roads. Every single hybrid that's sold in this state chips away at gasoline tax revenues to fix the roads. It's a simple question. Where are you going to get that money from? I know some of the money is federal money. I get it. But even that's in jeopardy now. So we have to act like adults here. Now, as far as I'm concerned, and you can disagree with me on this, love to hear from you, 203-333-9422-333-WICC. If you're going to tell people down the road, no pun intended, hey, you have to pay a per mile fee, half a cent a mile, quarter cent a mile, penny a mile, penny and a half a mile, 2 cents a mile. If you tell people you have to pay that and the state gasoline tax, that's going to be a hard no from me and a few million other people. Now, if you tell people you have to pay that road use fee, quarter of a cent up to 2 cents a mile, and you're getting rid of the gasoline tax, a lot of people may say, all right, I'm fine with that, which means that almost instantly gas would drop by 25 cents a gallon, 20, 25, 30 cents a gallon, right? Depending upon when you do that. Now, here's the squishy part here, right? Here's the part that you go, what if they said in Hartford, hey, we need a road use tax and we're going to cut the gasoline tax, not completely off every gallon you pay, but instead of 25 cents, it'll be 10 cents a gallon. So you got to pay 10 cents a gallon plus your road use fee. I'm okay, me personally, because I participated in a study. And for my purposes, the state told me, remember this a couple, three, 4 years ago? I allowed the state to monitor my driving. I'm okay. Big brother was fine. They didn't catch me going to Agumad's house. They probably caught me going to get my Chinese food once a week or once every couple of weeks. But I found that if I was going to pay a usage fee and not the gasoline tax, it'd cost me about another $5 a month more. So what are your thoughts on this? Are you at all open to paying a usage fee? In other words, they would have a device on your car, and then either once a month or once a year, you would have to, my guess is, you would have to put in some sort of a credit card or a debit card, and it would maybe automatically deduct whatever. When I did this for 4 months, it showed me that at the end of 4 months, I would have paid XYZ above the fuel tax. Because, folks, I'm telling you, it is coming. Not next year, probably, not the year after, but a road usage tax, penny a mile, if you drive 20,000 miles a year, penny a mile, $200. You may say, well, where am I going to get that from? Yeah, but what if they get rid of the gasoline tax? That's the rub here, because I'm telling you, I saw this in that bill summary last night. I said, it's on the way. Next gentleman here joins us. He's a labor fellow at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. You may remember his name. He was involved in a labor case that made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court years ago. I talked to this gentleman while that case was being heard. It's been a while. Frank Ritchie joins us. Hey, Frank, it's Paul Pacelli again. How are you?
Paul, honored to be on your show.
How you been? All right.
We've been doing great, but we can't say the same about Connecticut.
Yeah, so Frank, from a labor point of view, give us, people are really upset about this, Frank, this Terrence Cheng, nothing personal against the guy. I don't know this guy from Adam, but apparently you have a guy here who was caught, you know, playing fast and loose, although nothing illegal with state money, yet they're going to kind of just, Frank, let him ride off into the sunset with his full salary. What are your thoughts on that?
Paul, well, it is personal because it's betraying the taxpayers' trust. We know, the governor knows, that he abused that trust. He put all kinds of expenses on the credit card when people in Connecticut are just trying to get by and pay their electric bill, Paul. Mm-hmm. And here, this individual betrays the public's trust, and then they just move the problem. Where's the accountability? Where's the due process? Bring him up on charges and terminate him or suspend him, but instead they move him to a cushier job, give him some fancy title of strategic analysis or something along those lines, where he has less responsibility but receiving essentially close to the same pay. It's an affront to good governance, and it goes to show that not only do we have a union problem in Connecticut, we also have a management problem as well.
You know, Frank, my thought here when we read and you outlined that well as to, you know, what the end of this would be, just to let him kind of slide into that new position. You know, Frank, and this is only my opinion. I don't know from Adam what they talked about, obviously. But to me, this is just like, let's just like brush it up. We don't want to deal with the unions. We don't want to get hurt, get in the middle of a lawsuit. And my guess is the governor and the staff probably said, no, we're not going to spend all these billable hours. Let's just push it down the road, go la, 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 and wait till he finishes up. That's my thought. I don't know what you think, but to me, it was like, let's not get into a middle of a lawsuit here, which I don't know, Frank, may or may not have happened. I don't know.
I think they could have clearly terminated this individual for just cause. Mm-hmm. This is somebody in a high position of responsibility that's representing the colleges of Connecticut. And for a professional to do that on the taxpayer's dime is irreparable. It's the height of absurdity of what we see. We're doing better with transparency in Connecticut, but what we don't have is accountability. You just mentioned the social service audit.
Yeah.
If you look at the audits from Connecticut, from all their departments, there's something that's really telling about those audits is that you keep seeing where they say there's repeated findings.
Yeah.
I believe, without looking at it, I think there was 25 findings and 19 of them were repeated, or 19 or 16 were repeated.
Mm-hmm.
So where's the accountability when we find there to be an issue? Now, I'm not saying that every employee needs to be terminated or suspended,
sure. Yeah.
But there's an indication that if you're having repeated findings, is anybody being held accountable? Is anybody being retrained? Are they being disciplined? You know, there's a whole bunch of different ways to handle it, but it seems like Connecticut just brushes things under the rug and says, don't worry about it, Paul. The taxpayers will pay for it.
Well, exactly. Frank Ritchie is the guest. He's a labor analyst, labor fellow with the Yankee Institute. And Frank, I say it all the time here on the show, there seems to be an overriding attitude from the majority in Hartford that, hey, you know, the people of Connecticut, all they are, to me, this is what it sounds like, Frank, ATMs. We need a little more money here. We need a little more money here. Let's hike this tax. Let's hike that fee. And, yeah, because you know what? We're going to be in the majority, so what the heck? What choice do they have? That's the feeling I get.
Well, good governance should really transcend politics. And a perfect example of this is the governor recently gave a speech at ASME's convention where he promised them raises before negotiations. I was a union president in New Haven.
I know, yeah.
And I had the honor of seeing John DeStefano negotiate. Now, here, John was a Democrat, but he put the taxpayers' interests first in negotiations, and both sides had to balance their interests. Here you have the governor conceding one of the major issues in negotiations, and what that does is it sets up the negotiations instead of being a give and take. The unions already know, hey, wait a second, we already got our hand in the taxpayers' pocket.
Yeah.
We're getting wages, so what else can we get? Because in negotiations, Paul, you're either side is either on defense or offense. They're either trying to get more or protect what they have. The governor, by his speech, just put the unions on offense. Now we need to get more out of the taxpayers. And don't get me wrong, I want public employees treated fairly.
Sure.
But I also want the taxpayers to be treated fairly. And there is, I can't find another example. This is so egregious for the governor to basically negotiate in bad faith by just saying, hey, I'm going to give you raises every year that I'm here when we already know they just received a 33% raise when you put in the step increases from the last contract.
Yeah.
How many of your listeners have received a 33% raise,
Frank,
in the last?
I wonder what happened when he said that. I could almost see the memes of his budget people's faces face-palming and the CBAC negotiators licking their chops when they heard that, right?
Absolutely. And one of the things, Paul, that gets lost in all this budget guardrail conversation and the pension crisis that got us in the mess that we're in is a lot of your listeners probably don't realize that in 1971 or 72, the Connecticut legislature passed a law that said the pensions had to be properly funded.
Yep.
So if they followed the law, we would have never had any pension crisis. We would have been able to pay benefits and also maybe tax cuts and money for education and other vital programs. But what they did was, Connecticut is a little bit of an outlier in most states, is they allow the unions and the governor to supersede state law. So the unions agreed with the governor, from both parties, to not properly fund the pension. And that's what created this avalanche that's crushing everything else. We need to stay within the guardrails, and Governor Lamont needs to take a labor management negotiation class. But I got a feeling he knows what he's doing, and this is political giveaways. This isn't about negotiating in good faith.
Yeah, coming up with an election, too. Frank Ritchie, Yankee Institute, Labor Fellow. Frank, good to speak with you again. I'm sure we'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me on, Paul. Great show.
Appreciate it. Frank Ritchie there, Labor Fellow, Yankee Institute. Welcoming in, though, while we have time, our buddy Thane Rosenbaum, legal analyst extraordinaire at CBS News, to talk about this case, man. The twists and turns in this one. Thane, good afternoon. How are you, sir? We talk of Mahmoud Khalil here. How are you?
Hey, buddy. It's good to hear your voice always, and love your show, Paul.
Thank you. Appreciate that. So we now have, what, dueling courts, Thane, saying dueling things about Mr. Khalil. What's the latest today, I see?
Well, here's the interesting thing. When he was picked up in New York, he was initially taken for a very short period of time to New Jersey.
Yeah.
And then almost instantly from there was taken to Louisiana in a detention facility there with the stripping of his visa, of course, in his green card, and a deportation order to be sent back somewhere. I can't remember exactly where he was supposed to be back. This was under Marco Rubio's statutory authority when you under a very a provision that says if you're interfering with American foreign policy, you are immediately deportable and your legal status is eliminated. The little stopover in New Jersey, short though it may be, Paul, turned out to create a real wrinkle because a federal court, New Jersey, as you know, is a blue state.
Yeah.
And a federal judge is much more likely to slow this down and to say, whoa, where are we going with this? You can't just take him in the middle of the night and send him someplace. He'd require some due process. An immigration court, which is a court under the executive branch, not the judicial branch, in Louisiana, could care less about this guy. It would have taken them 6 seconds to say, get rid of him now. This is would have been, again, immigration courts are under the executive branch. They're not our Article III courts. So that's the concept, right, that you have a guy sitting in Louisiana who's ready to go, and no one's going to stop him because it's a red state and he's an immigration court. Now, all of a sudden, there's an order in New Jersey saying, wait a minute, I have jurisdiction over him because he spent 5 minutes in New Jersey before they sent him away. That's the interesting thing. That's what ultimately happened. A federal judge here in New Jersey said, look, he needs some due process. He's supposed to have some hearing. There has to be some evidentiary hearing that produces the proof of what he was engaged in. And the Secretary of State has an obligation to show me why he is, in fact, a threat to American foreign policy. Now, Rubio is saying, no, I don't have any obligation to talk to you at all. You know, that's his position. He's going, this is my unilateral authority. I'm the Secretary of State, and you're not. And so how did you decide that you're conducting my foreign policy? I am saying that anyone that was leading protests on behalf of Hamas in a university campus and who headed up a student organization that called for the dismantling of Western civilization, he is standing in the way of American foreign policy. Why? Israel is an ally. Two, we don't tolerate anti-Semitism. And three, we still have a war on terror, and this guy seems to be supporting terror. That's the Rubio's position. He is deportable under any number of different statutes, including the Patriotism Act, the Anti-Terrorism Act, and my own little pocket thing that I have here that says if I unilaterally decide he's a threat, he's out. So that's where we are. Now you have a federal judge who's exerting his authority, and he's saying, not only am I taking jurisdiction of it, but I'm ordering him released, sending him back to his wife and child.
Wow. Thane, I ask you this all the time, but is this another case of where the Supreme Court steps in and says, hey, wait a minute, or do they want nothing to do with this?
Well, they're going to have to act. You know, a lot of these cases are all really related, Paul, because they go to what President Trump is saying. You know, can a single judge have this kind of power over the Article II powers of a president to conduct foreign policy and national security? Remember, after 9/11, Paul, as you know, if you invoke the words national security, a whole new package of laws enter into the, you know, everyone's mind gets blown. The minute you say that, oh my God, national security, then we tolerate some things that we would never otherwise tolerate. That's what Guantanamo Bay was. You know, all of these issues debating about, you know, torture, enhanced interrogation techniques, waterboarding, all of this came in the aftermath of the words national security and terrorism. So Rubio's position is, you know, unmovable. He's saying this is not the business of a federal court. And the Supreme Court has to really weigh in largely on what are the limits, if any, of Article II powers on the president when it comes to foreign policy. Is there what's called the unitary executive theory, which means that the chief executive of the country, the president of the United States, pretty much gets to run the business of the executive branch without interference. And that's what this is about. And the Khalil case is part of that because it deals with the executive branch, which is the State Department. And the State Department can conduct its national security and foreign policy and how it deals with people that it deems to be an enemy of the state.
Thane, great, as always. Thane Rosenbaum, CBS News. Thane, take care. We'll chat down the road.
Anytime,
thank you,
buddy.
Sir. Thanks. Appreciate it. Thane Rosenbaum there. Well, there you have it, folks. I love when we have Thane on. Thane Rosenbaum, CBS News. And we turn to this guy at this time, midweek Wednesday, every Wednesday afternoon at 5:15, to try and explain the stuff that I either don't understand or makes my head explode. Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media, senior editor and columnist. Mr. Haar, good afternoon, sir. How might you be today?
Great. I'm doing great. We're richer today than we were yesterday, and unfortunately we're looking at the future is not so bright, but boy, is the present good.
Yeah. All right. So Let's start from the, before we get to the present, let's start from the top here. You have been doing more writing on the first 100 days of number 47, Mr. Trump in the Oval Office. What do you have on that for us?
Well, we've been out all week, last week and this week. We're airing on Channel 3. I'm a TV reporter this week.
Yeah.
On WFSB Channel 3. We've had a segment every day at 5:30. I got a haircut on the air.
Nice.
Live and talked to the barber about Trump politics. Mm-hmm. The observations that I am finding are that, there are more Trump supporters in Connecticut out and around.
Yeah.
Obviously, the polls don't show as many because, you know, people are not necessarily out and around. But when you stop people in the street, you're finding more Trump supporters than you might think.
Really?
Yes, even in Hartford. And we had that during the election, as you recall.
Yeah.
And B, the Trump supporters that we do have in Connecticut tend to be equivocating. They will like this and they won't like that. My mm-hmm. favorite one, which will be in a column upcoming,
yeah.
is this woman who started out. She was a retired lawyer in Manchester,
okay.
And we interviewed her, and she started out by saying, "He's a pig. He's an absolute pig."
Okay. Right?
So we're thinking, you know, you're settling in for another Democratic rant.
Okay.
And then she said, "But he's doing a good job." what we're finding is that that's not atypical. That is. That's
yeah.
What you find. And it's not necessarily that people don't like the same things. Yeah. Maybe one person doesn't like Ukraine. Another person doesn't like Doge. Another person doesn't like the El Salvador prison.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily the same things, but it's very hard to find somebody who absolutely loves everything that Trump is doing.
Yeah, Dan, it's interesting, and that really reflects a lot of the calls I get here on the show daily, every afternoon here, Monday through Friday, like, all right, I wish you would be a little X, a little less on X, Y, but boy, do I love Z. Like, X and
right.
Y, he's a little bit crazy, but boy, it seems like, Dan, you're right, he seems to check off at least one major box for everybody you talk to, you know?
Right. Now, anti-Trump people...
Yeah.
Not so much.
Yeah.
It was equally hard to find somebody who was a Trump opponent who had anything good to say about him at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, we asked every single person, is there anything good you like about him? Anything you like about him? And one person said, you know, yeah, he can't be president forever. Another person said, yes, the court decisions reining him in. So there was one fellow that we talked to in Southington. And he was a fairly young black gay man.
Okay.
And he said, I didn't vote for him, but I don't feel oppressed the way I thought I would.
Interesting. Interesting. I love when people don't fall into, no matter on what side of the aisle, they don't fall into these pre-described notions. Dan Harz with us, Hearst Connecticut Media. Okay. I know you love to talk numbers. You're great at breaking that down. So, revenue forecasts and projections. What do we have there, Dan?
Weird stuff. The numbers just came out a half an hour and a half ago,
yeah.
A little before 4 o'clock. And for this current year,
mm-hmm.
with only a couple of months left, as compared to the January forecast of state tax collections, we are up $552 million.
Wow.
Now, that's not going to affect spending. Because it's too, you know, even the most liberals are not going to say, oh, gee whiz, we have $500 million in our pockets. Let's go spend it now. Right. Because you only have 2 months. Because starting in the next fiscal year, 26,
yeah.
We are down $150 million and 27. And so what's happening is that the sales tax is down significantly in
really?
The future years.
Yeah.
But they haven't seen. And again, this is predictions based on economic modeling. And so this morning's report, which I'm sure you've been talking about the negative economy in the first quarter,
mm-hmm.
right? Albeit it's not a fundamental decline. In other words, it's not U.S. output that's down. It is imports that are up, right?
Yeah, I did see that. Yeah, the balance here, I was reading that a little while ago. Yeah, okay.
Right. Because remember, GDP is a whole bunch of razzmatazz, but one of them is the balance of but what you're buying and what you're selling.
Yeah.
And so it's net exports, right? So net exports were negative. But in any case, without getting into a lot of econometrics, the long and the short of it is that there doesn't take a brilliant mind to see that the economy might be slowing heading into 26. And that's where you get the decline in sales tax. So there's a lot of worry. And then, of course, none of the potential federal grant declines,
yeah,
the cuts in federal grants, none of that is reflected in today's numbers because, as one person said to me, we deal in black and white.
Mm.
Right. And so.
So how does this then, Dan Harp, project into the ongoing negotiations about the budget and the spending caps and the guardrails and what the governor may or may not give state union people in the coming years? How does this all shake out with that? Or do we know yet?
I think it helps the hardliners who say hold the line, because the $550 million extra that we have for this year,
mm-hmm,
is money in the bank, and we're going to put it to pay down the pensions. The governor might try to take some of this year's surplus,
yeah,
not just next year, but this year's surplus, and start to seed his early childhood trust fund,
sure,
for education. Yeah. I suspect he's going to say, let's start early on that. Rather than pay the pensions down by an additional $1.5 billion, let's pay them down by $1.2 and let's take the $300 million now. Mm. And I don't think there'll be much argument about that if he does it. But going forward, look, when the projections say you're going to be down, you don't spend more money. And I think this gives them that good argument, combined with the weakening economy, mm, combined with the threat to federal grants.
And Dan, finally, that $550 million, and you may have mentioned it, or forgive me if I didn't lock in on it, that additional tax revenue is sales tax, income tax, capital gains. Where's that $550 coming from?
It's kind of across the board. I'm looking at the chart right now. Withholding is up 110.
All right.
Oh, the rich people. most of it is the rich people.
Ned's friends.
And finals.
The governor's friends, in other words, right?
Yeah, it's estimates and finals. Sales and use tax is flat, followed by a decline in the following year. But $350 million of the $552 million is the line item is called estimates and finals. It's capital gains, interest, dividends, and small business income.
There you go, the rich guys. Well, Dan, thank you. Dan Harr, Hearst Connecticut Media, every Wednesday at this time. Of course, you can read him online, all the Hearst publications, and he's on Channel 3 now. How about that? Now, Dan, you know, you may need an agent. You may need an entourage soon. Are you all right with this now? Can you handle it?
Well, they tripled my pay for this week.
How about that, huh? All right, Dan, be good, buddy. Have a good weekend.
Zero times three, my friend.
I kind of knew that's where you were going. Thanks, Dan. Be good. Dan Harr, Hearst Connecticut Media. All right, check him out.